Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hi, this is Alan, and this is The Vox Pop. And welcome for this Monday, July 30th. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. With more than 20 locations across the greater Saratoga region, Saratoga Hospital, people you trust, care you deserve. SaratogaHospital.org for information. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Jennifer Michaels. We love her, of the Breen Center for Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services in Weston, Massachusetts. She's here to answer your questions about addiction, mental health, and related topics. You know, a lot of people are going to call 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Michaels, your calls all coming up on the Vox Pop. When? Right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. We're really lucky today. One of our favorite guests joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues is Dr. Jennifer Michaels, medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for more than 15 years. Dr. Michaels, always wonderful to see you here. It is, you just bring such light into my day, and I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So I asked you a question when we were getting our coffee, and I said to you, so Jen, why? I don't get it with young people. I don't get why they take the first hit, first heroin hit or the first opioid hit. Why is it that they put it into themselves?
That's a great question. I don't know if anyone listening would like to call in. In my experience, young people are just continuing to experiment on a path, and a friend has it. Maybe they don't have the substance they want, but they have a pill or they have some heroin, and why not try it just this once? They may hear, well, you don't have to inject it. You could just snort it, so it feels relatively benign. But that's how it starts. It's really insidious, and it slowly builds up.
And we would, of course, as you mentioned just now, love to hear from anybody who has, imbibed or taken it, and we'd love to hear your story. But in any case, we'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, let's make it fast. Go ahead.
Do addicts have lower levels of dopamine and serotonin than non-addicts?
Okay, that's a good question. It's not black and white. It varies. But in general, if you chronically use a drug, you will, what we call downregulate or turn off your dopamine system. And the dopamine is our feel-good neurotransmitter system. So when people try to stop, they don't have that feel-good neurotransmitter. So that compels them to keep using. And one other thing, if people have a substance use disorder, they're twice as likely to have a co-occurring mental health issue, like depression, like anxiety, and especially depression speaks to a problem with serotonin.
So which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
They go hand in hand. So having depression, anxiety, bipolar predisposes you to substance use, and having substance use disorders predisposes you to these other mental health issues.
Huh. Jim, thank you. All right, let's go to Lynn Marie in Albany. The telephone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 1-800-348-2551. You can get online now. You'll certainly get in within seconds. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. Lynn Marie, it's your turn. Go. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Lynn.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about food addiction today. I wanted to see if there's any way that you can give me any kind of sense of how to break this vicious cycle.
Okay. Well, I am not someone who practices treatment for food addiction usually, so there are probably other people out there who are better at this. But there are self-help groups. There's Overeaters Anonymous. There are many other groups out there. So you might want to Google self-help groups for eating disorders and also programs that specialize in treating eating problems, because it is a very specific type of treatment. There's a combination of medication and therapies such as cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy. These modalities can be very helpful. And for severe cases, people go to residential.
What kind of a therapist, ma'am, what kind of a therapist deals with food addiction?
Someone who is very familiar with a technique called cognitive behavioral therapy.
Oh, okay. And you have no, can refer to me to one.
Well, there are
that you know of.
There are specialty programs that exist, and you might want to contact them. You can also go to SAMHSA, S-A-M-H-S-A, and put in treatment for food addiction and see if there are recommendations there. But I don't know of
okay,
a specific
and
person.
It was, the word was SAMHSA?
It's S-A-M-H-S-A. It's Substance Abuse Mental Health Services
okay.
of America.
S-A-M-H-A-S.
H-S-A. It's SAM.
S-A-M.
H-S-A.
Oh, S-H-A. S-H-A.
H-S-A.
H-S-A.
SAM H-S-A.
H-S-A. All right,
yes.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I wish you
thank
well.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you,
Lynn.
Bye-bye.
And Alan, it's a very specialized treatment. Not many people treat eating disorders, so it's important to go to someone who has a lot of experience in that area.
But speaking for myself, I can tell you that I like to eat. And, holding back is just this morning, I was walking by my friend James, who works for us over in the other building there. Does a terrific job, and he had these chocolate-covered cookies with chocolate goo inside of them. I don't know what they're called. And I've been very good lately. And I saw them and said, can I have one of those? And boom, within 2 seconds, it was down the gullet and gone. Now, I get it. I get how impulsive this kind of thing can be. In any case, it's 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Will in Albany. All right, Lil, you're on. Will, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been in a pain management program at Kona NIA, Dr. Bob Paglow, and we meet every month to talk about pain management alternatives. That I have been on methadone for 5.5 years, and I take 1 to 4 per day on the level of my pain. And I have been doing well, but I'm wondering, is this good, bad, or indifferent?
Okay, that's a very good question. I think good or bad, the answer would be, how are you doing? I mean, if your pain is in good control and you can function well and live your life, then it's a good thing. That works for some people. Other people are on pain medicine and are stuck on the couch and are not involved with family. I just spoke to a patient yesterday about this, or last week, I should say, and she was on pain medicine, and it made her life smaller, not bigger. And so I think that's the question to ask. What is your functionality? What is your joy level while you're taking this medicine? Can you answer that?
Yes, and I am keeping involved. The church is a big part of my life. Interacting with other people, I go to 1 to 2 support groups per week, and I feel active. I'm always wanting to exercise more, but every once in a while I'll fall into couch potato. But there, I don't watch it endlessly. I pick an hour and a half of programming that I enjoy.
Hey, Will, we're approaching a break, but I did want to get Dr. Michaels a little chance to respond to you. Go ahead.
Sure. It sounds like for you, it's a success. You're living your life and you're engaged. My only suggestion would be to create a routine so that you will be more active and your body will expect a little exercise if you do it at the same time every day. But it sounds like you're doing great.
Okay. Thanks, Will. Okay. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture. Specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients, windhorsenaturopathic.com. Adirondack Oral Surgery, Albany, Clifton Park, and Glens Falls, offering a range of oral and maxillofacial surgery, including wisdom teeth extraction, dental implants, oral pathology, and more. AdirondackOralSurgery.com. Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, less than 50 minutes from Albany, offering minimally invasive procedures for back pain with Dr. Shen and Dr. Popper. NLH.org for more information. New York Oncology Hematology, introducing its new 4-ring mobile PET and CT with QClear technology, Albany, Amsterdam, Clifton Park, Hudson, and Schenectady, New York. Oncology.com to schedule. And from Washington County Tourism, featuring craft beverage tours, cheese tours, and farm-to-table restaurants, WashingtonCounty.fun for more details.
And we are back with Dr. Jennifer Michaels. Phones are ringing. If you want to get online, now's a great time to do it. Could change your life, no question about it. Let's go to Cassandra in Shandaken. Okay, Cassandra, you're on.
Hey, I had a question. So I'm in recovery myself, and I also have now transitioned into having my KSAC. So I'm also an alcohol and substance abuse counselor. But I'm kind of interested on what your thoughts are regarding harm reduction, specifically medical cannabis, and also what your thoughts are like medical cannabis as a form of medication-assisted treatment.
Well, congratulations, number one, on attaining your KDAC, which means that you can professionally treat people who have substance use disorders. I think that the jury is out right now. We don't know all the potential good and the potential consequences of medical cannabis. I don't see it as medication-assisted treatment. That's very specific when we think about opioid use disorder and using something like Suboxone or methadone or something called Vivitrol. But there are some cases where people have muscle spasms or have muscle wasting where it's been shown that cannabis is helpful. I think the more we can professionalize it and medicalize it, the better. I am concerned about people who have substance use disorders piling on medical marijuana and using it as a reason, to smoke it because they have anxiety or depression or sleep issues. We can treat those problems with medications other than marijuana, and they're not going to get people high. I think we're in transition, though, with this.
Follow up, Cassandra?
Yeah, I mean, well, I had taken a understanding medical cannabis course at college just recently. So it was a really innovative course. And we had kind of discussed how research is going for it being used as a harm reduction technique. If there's an individual using IV heroin daily and if they're able to remain abstinent, from that with the use of medical cannabis, there was some research that suggested it was really successful.
Okay, let's get an answer. Okay, go ahead.
So in our experience, when people are using heroin or other opioids and they've tried the marijuana approach, they end up smoking marijuana and using the opioid. The studies that I've seen have looked at brief inpatient detox and using marijuana just for a few days while people are detoxing, and it helps to alleviate symptoms, but so do other more traditional medicines like Suboxone or methadone. So right now, that's not something that I would support. because it's not good to pile on other levels of substances or medications. That's what we see.
You got your answer, Cassandra. Thank you. Okay, and now we're going to go to Bob in Rensselaer. Okay, Bob in Rensselaer, you're on.
Hello?
Hey, Bob, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
With all the medication terms out there, I hear one called self-medication, and I'm just kind of curious what that means. Like, does there have to be a diagnosis, or does it, before you can say self-medication, or, you know, just kind of wondering about that term.
Okay, good question. Now, self-medication is a term that applies to people who, for example, may have bipolar disorder, and when they're really depressed, they'll use something like cocaine to lift their mood. So they're self-medicating a psychiatric symptom. Or maybe when they're really manic, they're going to drink a lot and use opioids to calm down. And we do see people do this, but I think what's behind that is a probable diagnosis of cocaine use disorder and opioid use disorder. The idea that if we treat the bipolar, the person won't have to use any substances is a bit idealistic. People who are self-medicating also are abusing substances.
So it's not a good term.
It's just not a specific term. We don't really talk about that term. We talk about having a problem or an addiction to a substance and a co-occurring mental health issue.
Thank you, Bob. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. There are five people on the line, which means if you get on line right now, you'll get in. I'm telling you that. I've been around here for a long time. And right now, we're going to go to none other than Shazara of Niskayuna. And I'm sure I murdered your name, Shazara. What? Can you help us with that? I think she hung up. That's too bad. It doesn't look good. All right, so we're going to ask her to call back, and we'll go to Greg in Saratoga. Greg in Saratoga, your turn.
Yeah, hi. How you doing, everybody?
Good.
Hi.
Good. I just wanted to make some comments about, the limitations of, and this isn't a diatribe or anything, but just in my own experience. I have a son who was 38 years old. He was just recently diagnosed with autism, and we had recognized he had developmental problems and other problems since he was very young. And it took the experts, and he had seen many psychologists and psychiatrists and neurologists, and no one identified autism. So here it took, 38 years to get the proper diagnosis. So I just, wanted to point out that the experts in this case had greatly failed in the sense that they didn't know what they had. And, my son sort of points this out to me. Now we've gotten him properly identified, so he's being treated by the OMR by the developmental disability people, who have a totally different understanding and aspect of changing people's behavior. And just as a comparison, the mental health model is high-powered drugs that they were trying to use, and in some ways he's become addicted and had some side effects from these drugs. So I just wanted to point out to the general public and to yourselves as well that people can walk into a room and you'll get a diagnosis, and it may be totally inappropriate.
Okay, and here we go back to Dr. Michaels. Go, Jen.
Well, I think the field is evolving. We have a lot to learn. We've learned a lot. We don't know everything about the brain. And I think also there's a concept of treatment matching, that some people do extremely well in community mental health. Other people need a specific kind of program that works for them. And people should have options. And if you're not satisfied, try something different. I think you're a good example of that.
And so there's an autism scale, obviously, that people are on. We're finding out more and more about that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's evolving.
And Greg, thank you for that call. Appreciate your talking to us about that. All right. Let's go now to Nancy in Kingston. Nancy in Kingston, your turn.
Hi. I have a science question, but I'm not a scientist, so be patient and you might have to translate. But I've read that there are receptors in the body that function for the eating of casein or grains in the same way that, like, the receptors are the same as they are for opioids. So my question is, it's kind of going back to the food addiction question, but from a chemistry angle, is there a correlation between opioid addiction and people who do, like, overeat grains and and dairy, and is there a possibility that addictions run in families, like food addiction and drug addiction, and it just depends on the person in the family which one they're more likely to resort to for any number of reasons?
Okay, there's the question.
Well, you know, there are scans of brains of people who are addicted to drugs and people who are addicted to food, meaning they eat in a compulsive, out-of-control way, even though they don't want to eat and, you know, they're truly addicted. And they light up. Those two brains light up in similar ways. It's about dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter in the brain. It's about activating the reward center in your brain when you engage in compulsive, repetitive behaviors, whether it's compulsive gambling or food addiction or addiction to substances. We don't have all the answers. It does look like simple carbs are more likely to activate the brain in an addictive way or a drug way.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and what's kind of nice is some of the programs that work for drugs work for the compulsive eating. People can apply the skills to their eating problems. And we commonly see people show up for drug addiction who have co-occurring other addictions, food addiction, gambling addiction, things like that. Obviously, tobacco addiction, which is pervasive.
Okay, well, that's a great answer. Thank you for that. Okay, so now we have to know where to go next. I'm looking, because I always look at who has been hanging on the longest. Oh, we want to go to Chisara, who we either hung up on, but she hung up on us. Chisara, you're on.
Hi. I didn't have my radio on for a little while trying to make the call, so if you've already addressed this, I apologize. But I just wanted to, in a very non-confrontational way, address the way that Helen responded to the woman who was discussing food addiction. I imagine you were trying to show empathy, but you talked about impulsivity and lack of willpower, where she's speaking about a true addiction. Mm. And I imagine it's very hard for people who have a true food addiction. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to recognize that.
Okay, good.
What you said, trying to be helpful, might have been harmful.
Well, I was trying to be helpful, and I was also telling you that I have absolute rules for myself, and I don't eat cookies. And there was this cookie staring me in the face, and I ate it.
But I think that's an addiction.
Well, it may be part of a larger picture, but we'll go to Dr. Michael. She'll tell me how wrong I am. Go ahead, Jen.
Well, I think it's on a scale. Uh-huh. And, you know, what we can't really quantify is how badly you felt about that. I mean, did you have shame?
Yes.
Did you think about it a lot?
Still talking about it.
Yeah, you're still talking about it. And did you, you know, restrict yourself in other ways during that day with food? You know, so it's hard to measure how much someone is suffering. You know, I could go home and eat 3 gallons of ice cream and feel like, well, I feel great. You could go home and, you know, make yourself throw up or, you know, like
it's very.
I guess what I'm saying is if it's interfering with the quality of your life, if it's interfering with your ability to carry out activities, it's not so much a cookie or 3 gallons of ice cream. It's the impact on your life.
So think about all those people with diabetes, for example, even marginal type 2 diabetes, and they know they shouldn't be eating ice cream.
Yes.
But they eat it anyway.
And, you know, when people talk about addiction and it's their fault and we should blame the addicts, I say, well, the same thing. What about diabetes?
Sure.
And people who are overweight and they can't control their eating? Should we shame them and blame them?
No.
It's actually a brain disease manifesting in other parts of the body.
But, Jazara, I want to thank you for your comeuppance here. You're certainly justified in making the comment. Thanks again. All right. Wait a second. I said hang up. Didn't hang up. Hey, how come? Okay, now it hung up. Okay, now we are, of all places, going to talk to Denise in Lenox. Denise, you're on. Hello, Denise. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Michael.
Sure.
I have a sister who's in recovery, and she's being treated with Suboxone. And she's 72 years old, and it's very, very successful for her. It's the first time in 40 years that she's actually sought treatment. And I have heard recently from people in the recovery community that they frown upon the use of drugs like Suboxone and methadone. And I was wondering, I'd like to hear what Dr. Michaels has to say about that.
Okay, that's a really good question. First of all, I want to congratulate your sister. She is a shining example that recovery can happen to anyone at any time. 72 years old and she's in recovery, that, you know, that can happen at any time. So no one should feel hopeless, number one.
Yeah, it's a miracle.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. And treatment works. It sounds like she's getting treatment. So why are people so down on these medications? It would be kind of like if I had diabetes and someone said, you know, when are you getting off that insulin?
Yeah.
Like, why would you ever say to someone who's alive and well and on a medication that's working, when are you getting off that stuff? Jenny, you look great, but you should get off that stuff. Or why are you taking an antibiotic? You should fight that disease. You should fight the bacteria.
Right.
It's judgment. It's ignorance. It's not knowing that actually these medications are the most efficacious treatments for opioid use disorder, and that it is life-saving. And we need to start integrating evidence-based treatments, factual studies that demonstrate that they work and they save lives. They're not the only solution, but they're a huge part of the solution. So going back to the diabetic person, we give them insulin, which is the life-saving medicine, but then we teach them about diet, exercise, lifestyle. We can use that same template for people who have opioid use disorder. So kudos to your sister, and she's a shining example. And by the way, at her age, stay on the Suboxone. She does not need to taper off ever.
Thank you, Denise. Appreciate it. Okay, and now, oh boy, we're going to go to Jessica in Del... Whoa. Why? Why is that? I'm getting the instructions. We'll go to Jessica, and then we'll go to Glenda, okay? All right, let's go to Jessica in Delmar. Jessica in Delmar, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shartok. Hi, Dr. Michaels. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just have a question about the potential relationship between the use of ketamine and depression and anxiety. My wife has a history of depression and PTSD and very mild anxiety, which used to be properly treated with a combination of medication and therapy, regular therapy sessions. 4.5 years ago, she was in the hospital for a major surgery, and the doctors were having a hard time managing her pain because she's allergic to most naturally occurring opioids. So she was in a lot of pain, and one of the doctors gave her a push of 20 units, I don't know if it's milligrams, of ketamine, which immediately put her into this hallucinogenic state that was really terrifying for her. She thought she was dying. She was going down this tunnel. Everything was moving away from her. And the only way they pulled her out of it was by giving her Versed. So ever since then, like starting that very evening, her depression has become really treatment resistant. She has PTSD. She has almost daily panic attacks, which she never had panic attacks prior to this use of the medication. And we've tried everything to treat her. We have a great psychiatrist we see every 2 weeks. She's tried different forms of therapy. She sees a therapist every week. She's had transcranial magnetic stimulation. She's had ECT. She does DBT therapy. She's been inpatient.
Okay, Jessica, I think we got the picture, so let's go to Dr. Okay. Michaels. Go, Dr. Michaels.
No. May I just make my final point, though?
All right, sure.
I'm wondering if the single use, that single push of ketamine, my wife has never done any substance abuse before, doesn't get drunk, anything like that even, could that one single use of ketamine have had a lasting impact or some sort of damaging effect that's lasting on her brain?
Okay, good question. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Okay, good question. When I saw your question, I thought you were going to talk about ketamine as a treatment for depression. That actually is happening now, as you probably know, that in treatment-resistant depression, people are receiving ketamine. I have not heard of people having this kind of long-term response to one exposure to ketamine, but I would never say never. And, you know, it may be a number of factors. She was in the hospital. Maybe she was very sick. She had this terrible experience. It sounds like it was extremely traumatic. It could be related to that or the combination of what occurred.
Good call, Jessica. Okay. Thank you. All right, let's go to, as I promised, our wonderful receptionist here, Glenda in Catskill. Glenda in Catskill, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just have a comment I wanted to make in response to the woman who called about the food addiction.
Yeah.
And I have had amazing success through a program called Food Addicts
Anonymous. It's a program where basically we're, and it's not Overeaters Anonymous, which is very, very different. What's wonderful about Food Addicts Anonymous is that the people who are able to stay abstinent, and being abstinent is just basically a very healthy diet. And the people who are able to do that will help the people who are coming, the new people who are coming in. In this area, there's about five different meetings, the Albany area and, you know, Saratoga and this whole area. And it is quite an amazing meeting, amazing program. And I just wanted to let her know that if you're willing to go to the meetings and really try the program, I have not seen anyone who didn't succeed with, you know, keeping their food addiction, basically dealing with their food addiction and keeping abstinent.
Okay,
and,
Glenda, we're glad, we're glad we let you break the line. Let's go to Dr. Michaels.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think I just want to say that in general, there are all of these new self-help meetings springing up. There's something called Refuge Recovery, which uses a Buddhist approach to recovery. There's Hope Fiends. That's another program that started in Massachusetts. So thank you for sharing this other meeting that sounds different than the traditional 12-step meeting.
And thank you, Glenda. And now we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to talk to Sam and Patrick and Steven. That's only three people. We get a lot more than that in the last third of the program, 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Hawthorne Valley Waldorf School, Ghent, New York. Early childhood through grade 12 within a 900-acre biodynamic farm setting, a vibrant place to learn and grow. Summer tours available. Reserve online at hawthornevalleyschool.org. The bariatric program at Adirondack Health, Saranac Lake. Offering weight loss surgery and lifestyle education. Better health, better lives. AdirondackHealth.org. Patricia Dalton Fennell, founder of AHMA, and Amita Sakdev, MD, University of Michigan Medical School, conducting the training medical residents in the management of chronic illness project. AlbanyHealthManagement.com. Albany Distilling Bar and Bottle Shop, 75 Livingston Avenue, featuring an array of locally produced beverages, announcing Scavenger Hunt Saturday, August 11th, 2 p.m. AlbanyDistilling.com. And from Interim Healthcare, helping people remain at home for 48 years. Providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga, InTermHealthcare.com.
And we are back with Dr. Jennifer Michaels, one of my favorite people in the world. Here we go. And so let's go to, hanging on for a long time is Sam in Rhinebeck. Welcome, Sam. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello, Dr. Sam. I have a question that's perhaps a slight bit off topic, but it's about a medication called mirtazapine. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, an antidepressant, yes.
Okay, so basically the doctor prescribed it for me for mild depression and sleeplessness, and when I started taking it, and even when I cut it in half, I mean, I basically couldn't wake up until late in the afternoon, so I finally quit taking it, altogether. But I was reading about it, and there might be some long-term lasting effects after you quit taking it. Is that true?
I have not heard of long-term lasting effects. A couple of things. If you're taking a large dose and you suddenly stop it, you'll have symptoms of stopping that may be uncomfortable. That should not be long-lasting. And any problems that you have now related to it should go away. So if there is a problem, you should follow up with the doctor who prescribed it.
Now, Jen, isn't it... Wait, one second there, Sam. Isn't it possible that when some people take a medicine for the first time, the system has to become accustomed to it? That's my question for you.
Yes, it's very true. And so if someone has a mild side effect initially, we ask people to continue on the medicine to see if that will go away so that they will get the good effects without the bad effects.
Right. Well, I mean, I basically didn't feel like waking up until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So, I mean, that was a bad effect.
That's a very bad effect. Yeah. So that, you know, if you were a little tired in the morning, I might say to you, you know, give it a few more days at that dose. But if you're not waking up till 2, then that medicine should be stopped.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Sam.
Okay, well, thank you, doctor.
Thank
appreciate
you,
it.
Thank okay. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Patrick in LaGrangeville. Patrick, you're on.
Hello. First of all, about your cookie obsession there, if Ray Graff was there, he'd say something like, Alan, of course you're not ashamed. You have no shame.
Right.
Anyway.
Quite right. That's exactly what he'd say.
Yeah, something. I wish he would said it, though. Anyway, I just wanted to, you know, go back to the cannabis thing. And I heard the doctor say there's not, you know, not enough scientific research. I completely disagree with that statement. I think there is a lot of scientific research. And I think that it is... could be as easily used as any of the other things she mentioned, that, oh, there's other things we could have you go on that the pharmaceutical industry puts out that, you know, won't cause you to get high. There are a lot of things related to cannabis and to hemp and to the CBD oils that don't cause people to get high. And there is a lot of science out there. It's that the government is slow on the uptake and stuff. But the general community at large is well ahead of the curve, and I think that it's a bit disingenuous. I'm not out for an argument or anything.
No, it doesn't sound like you're out for an argument since the first moment you got on the air, but
anyway,
go ahead.
That's my comment. I could go on, but I won't. I know you got a lot of callers.
Dr.
But
Michaels?
Thank you.
Let's let the doctor answer.
I'm sorry if it felt like I was saying it. There's no evidence for anything. I did mention for certain syndromes. There is evidence, actually. But my personal concern is that people will use cannabis for things like a major depression or bipolar or schizophrenia, or say, you know, if I smoke marijuana, I won't use heroin. And there isn't evidence that supports that. And I think that we should really look at the literature and studies that have been shown to support the efficacy and be cautious and careful.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. 1-800-348-2551. And now we go to Stephen in South Glens Falls. Stephen, you're on.
Alan, hi.
Hey.
Dr. Michaels.
Hello.
I am not a practicing psychiatrist, though I am an internist. My question relates to a prior caller, and your very last caller partially addressed that. This is not a confrontational question, but I'm interested in some of the verbiage you used. You had said that you did not feel medical marijuana was useful as co-treatment for opioid addiction, and then you used the term, we don't like piling medications on, and yet sometimes in our profession we get caught up in there are only certain types of medications, i.e., ones that are pharmaceutically produced by major companies, and we tend to pile them on. It sounded like a bit of a bias, and I'm not sure. Again, I'm interested in your feedback on what I heard.
And here we go.
Whether that's what you meant.
And here we go.
Well, I think we were focusing on opioid use disorder, and currently the medications that have saved lives that have worked are medications such as Suboxone, methadone, and Vivitrol.
Of course.
And we try to avoid other medications or substances that can make those medications less effective or dangerous. So, for example, I do not co-prescribe a benzodiazepine with an opioid because that increases the risk of overdose and overdose death.
Of course.
In much the same way, marijuana with THC can lead to some cognitive effects. I would not recommend that someone receiving those medications also use cannabis. I would recommend something more traditional until, as I said, more research is out. So that's what I meant when I said about, you know, keeping the evidence of for opioid use disorder, which is a very serious disease. It's a very serious illness. So we don't want to start adding on other substances when, in my mind, there isn't the evidence yet to support having someone use marijuana while they're taking Suboxone for opioid use disorder.
Okay, Dr. Stephen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
All right, now we'll go to, oh boy, this is a difficult one. Now we're going to go to Chris in Schenectady. Chris in Schenectady, your turn. Chris.
Hi, good afternoon, doctors. I'm calling about Vivitrol, and I wouldn't say the lack of prescribing, but not a lot of patients around the capital region, there's not a lot of doctors that prescribe it where they're able to help patients. So I'd like to know, like, a couple places for, you know, I have some friends who abuse, and I'm trying to get recovered from opiates, and there's not that much for them to do where Vivitrol is concerned. I mean, we all think it's a great drug, but to find a provider who prescribes it and able to monitor it, it's kind of difficult.
Okay, but
do you know of anyone around the area?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that Dr. Michaels is in charge of the major facility in Pittsfield. So whether, you know, so this may be a little bit more specific, as you know, to Schenectady. But anyway, go, Jennifer.
Okay. Just for people who are listening, Vivitrol is an opioid blocker. It's injected once a month in the butt, and it's a very effective medication. It blocks the opioid receptors. It's not associated with depression or very bad side effects. It's a little uncomfortable getting the injection. But what it does is it actually decreases cravings for alcohol, and it also helps people to not use opioids. And it's one of the three major medications we use. It is a challenge for some providers to store it and inject it, so it's less available than methadone or Suboxone. We provide it at the Breen Center, so people are welcome to go there. You might also be able to find providers if you call local addiction centers. I think there's an Albany Med Addiction Center. Something near you, they might be able to point you in the right direction. And people who are on Vivitrol should stay on it for quite a few months to get that benefit of opioid treatment.
Okay, Chris?
All right, thank you very much, doctors.
Thank you, bye. All right, and now on to Joan in Gilderland. Okay, Joan, your turn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to recall some things that I don't remember the exact medications of, but what I'm concerned about is that around 2007 to 2012, I was receiving some drug therapy from psychiatrists. And one of the things they did was combine my anxiety and depression. You know, there was an anxiety and depression combination of medications. I tried several. But the thing I'm concerned about is that I took Ambien as a sleep aid. This probably was a part of this issue was connected, I feel, with some like hormonal changes from going into menopause. I'm now 66. This was when I was in my 50s. And with the onset of menopause, there was this sort of anxiety, you know, rushes that happened, and I couldn't sleep, and they gave me Ambien. My question is whether there could have been residual effects, because I've had memory issues that I can date back to that time.
You mean from the Ambien, Joan?
Yeah, I think I feel that I'm. But my question is whether you feel that the Ambien could have had an effect at that point that might have been residual. I would stand and try to recall things and have a slow or none recall of what I did yesterday.
Okay, now listen, Joan.
It seems to show up.
Joan, I don't want to. I don't want to cut you off, but we're running out of time
just
here.
Just wanted to say.
Yeah. So it's a good.
The amount of time was about 6 or 7 months of taking it, and then I stopped.
Okay, here we go.
Did have residual effect. Do you think that's possible?
So that's not a really long time, number one. Number two, we know less about Ambien, or we call them Z drugs, than we do about benzodiazepines and cognitive impairment. There are some studies that show that benzodiazepines like Valium or Xanax, Ativan, may be associated with what you're describing. And then there are studies that don't even support that. Z drugs are related to benzodiazepines. The other probability is that if you went through menopause, that process can lead to some memory issues. And it's a very normal part of menopause and being postmenopausal. I can speak to it personally. It's not fun, but that may be why that's going on. So I'm less worried about the Ambien.
Okay, thank you, Joan. And now on to Lucia, I'm so sorry, in Waterville Eat. Okay, Lucia, you're on.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call.
My question, or I should say, I wanted to get Dr. Michael's opinion, how you would feel about potentially training emergency room physicians to prescribe, for instance, sorry if I'm mispronouncing, buprenorphine medication for patients that are coming in seeking treatment for addiction, because patients are having such difficulty getting into addiction treatment after they're seen into the emergency room, that maybe potentially prescribing some of these medications to kind of tie them over until they're in to see an addiction provider.
Okay, Lucia, thank you. We're just running out of time. Thank you. That's a very good question. Jen?
It's a wonderful question. Just so people know, buprenorphine is a medication for opioid use disorder. It addresses craving and withdrawal, and it's very effective. So what we're seeing currently is people are showing up in the emergency room in overdose. Their lives are saved. They wake up and they're given a list of places to follow up with to get their buprenorphine, maybe 3 days, maybe 3 weeks down the road.
Yeah.
And that's way too much time. This is a medical emergency. And as Lucia said, strike while the iron's hot. They're in the emergency room. We should start buprenorphine there and get them connected. We call it a bridge clinic. Get them connected to a program so there's no lapse, and that reduces the vulnerability of overdose. Studies support doing that. Deaths go down dramatically when we start buprenorphine in the emergency room.
And how about at the Berkshire Medical Center? Do we do that?
We are in the process of making that happen right now.
Cool. That's great.
We're going to make it happen.
Thanks, Lucia. Okay, let's go to Doris in Springfield. Doris in Springfield, your turn.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Dr. Chartok and Dr. Michaels. I'm not addicted to opioids or anything, but I do have a depression, and I take citalopram, but I also have grade 3 heart failure, mitral valve stenosis, pulmonary arterial hypertension. And citalopram seems to make me weak. I get heart palpitations and heart flutters. Is there another drug that might not affect the heart?
Well, there are many other medications, and I think that would be a great conversation to have with your provider, along with your cardiologist and pulmonologist involved in the discussion.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Keep
so
trying.
Much. Okay, we only have a couple of seconds, but this over the internet. Hi, Dr. Michaels. Is love just chemical? Is being in love just the result of dopamine? Thank you, Michael.
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that. Yeah. I think it's beyond chemistry. It's interesting. Last night at our house, we were talking about pheromones and how there are now companies that will collect your T-shirt armpits and then collect them and mail them out with your profile. And you can sniff your potential date as well as read the profile because it may be pheromones that are a component.
Isn't that interesting? Sniff your date.
Sniff your date. Yeah. I don't think we have the answer to that. There's oxytocin, which is released. It's kind of a hormone that is involved in this. And there are many different hormones involved, but I think it's so complicated, we really don't know.
Okay, and Ellen, and we only have a couple of seconds for this, Jen, is why is the suicide rate in Berkshire County the highest in the state? Is there a correlation between income, lack of health insurance, and suicide? Is there a shortage of mental health resources to help prevent suicide?
Well, I think studies have shown that lack of finances, this current drug epidemic is part of it, crumbling of the family fabric.
Yeah.
We have institutions moving out. We had GE move out. I think it's all contributing. And I think also that the national conversation is contributing too. People don't feel safe and they don't feel connected or necessarily as members in this country. I think there's a lot going on contributing.
Of course, a lot of people commit suicide who have plenty of money.
Yes. And the other thing I want to say about suicide is almost always impulsive.
Yeah.
If there are ways some barriers we could put in between that split second that people are thinking about it before they're acting, put guns in safes, don't have dangerous materials, that don't let your pill supply be available to other people, that would reduce suicides too.
Here we go. We're just about out of time. My apologies to no one because no one was left on the line. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels. We love her of the Breen Center for being with us today. Very generous of you to come over and join us, Jen. WMC Heart and Vascular Institute is a support for Medical Monday with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our wonderful engineers, Zach Malloy, Joe Makowitz, for answering the phones, our producers, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.